Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hour number two of your Ben Jarofsky Show is brought to you by SEIU Healthcare, Illinois, Indiana, the Chicago Federation of Labor, and the Chicago Reader. Ben, take it away.
Miles Kampflassen joining us from In These Times. Miles Kampflassen, the pride and joy of Whitney Young High School and of several rock bands. Huge Bulls fan. We're going to really show discipline, Miles. We're not going to discuss our beloved Bulls, even though they were victorious last night, correct? We're not going to discuss them, right?
Not a word.
Okay. Love you, Zach LaVine. Sorry. I just couldn't resist that one. Miles, I told you this before the show. I texted you before the show. It's like In These Times week on the Ben Jarofsky Show. Mindy Iser, a colleague of yours from In These Times, was our guest over the weekend. She did a great job. It was her debut. She shamed me for shaming Trump voters. It was a spirited conversation, and I'm definitely going to invite her back. And then Leonard Goodman, another In These Times contributor, was on, and he was ripping Democrats. Leonard is even to the left of me, which I didn't think was possible to find anybody to the left of me. Now you coming on the show. You're a writer for In These Times and an editor. I believe you're Mindy's editor, right? Sometimes you edit her copy. Yeah. You wrote a great essay column. I call them columns. I don't know what you call them for In These Times. How to Avoid Another Monster Like Trump. And that's the headline. And it just sums everything up, because on one hand, you talk about the monster that Trump is and was. And then you talk about what the Dems should do in the Biden administration to prevent another monster like Trump from emerging. So it's both things. Hello, Biden. Goodbye, Trump. So before we get to the hello Biden part of it, why don't you talk about the goodbye Trump part of it and your assessment 4 years later of Donald Trump's reign as president?
Sure. Well, thank you very much for having me, as always, as my first appearance on the Ben Jarofsky Show this year. I just want to start by wishing happy and safe 2021 to both you and Dr. D, a.k.a. D. Nice, as he's more commonly known now. Yes. You know, we made it through the madness of 2020 and are still standing. So, you know, may the new year bring us all more joy and triumph on our journeys through the struggle. This is Donald Trump's last full day in office right now. We somehow have made it from, a very dark day in January of 2016. I was actually on the streets of Washington, D.C. protesting Donald Trump's inauguration 4 years ago. 2017, sorry. Mm-hmm. He spoke of American carnage and had a speech written by Steve Bannon, who I know you brought up earlier. It was a really scary moment for me, not just because of the threat that Donald Trump posed to our country and our democracy, but also because there was an emerging consensus that Trump might be able to perform some kind of political realignment, right? By running on like a worker-friendly agenda and investing in doing a big infrastructure bill. There was a huge case in Indiana where, you know, Trump said he stopped a company from moving overseas and was saving jobs. You know, it was a real concern that he might be able to pull off some type of actual political strategy that hadn't been done before, that would build him some majority support while also being a rabid, you know, racist and xenophobe, anti-immigrant president. So you know, now we see that 4 years later, he squandered that entirely, right? I mean, there was no real attempt to do such a realignment. And in fact, Trump just carried out mass death. I mean, this is the worst year in American history we just lived through, including the Civil War. I mean, America's been around since 1776, and we just lived through certainly the deadliest and darkest year in our country's history. And we all feel it. I mean, you're recording from your attic. We're all, you know, our lives have been upended. And it's not solely Donald Trump's fault, but look around the world. I mean, we are unique, the United States, not just in the death count, but in how much our lives have been completely transformed for the worse because of the pandemic. And it's because Donald Trump didn't care. You know, he never cared about governance or about, you know, how the American people are doing. He only cared about the, you know, stock market and what people were saying about him, basically. I mean, it's real petty. I mean, he's always been a very petty dude, and that has become his politics. The thing he was effective at, though, was building a cult of personality, and we see that in the hordes of, mobs that stormed the Capitol, that, you know, their one unifying political principle was undying loyalty to Donald Trump, the man. And we shouldn't be surprised. I mean, he's the one who said, I alone can fix it, right? I mean, that was his whole, the running theme throughout his administration was all about him, which is why it's, you know, the Republican Party is in such a quandary now, because they need to decide whether they're going to just, you know, shut him off essentially and say, we're not going to, you know, have this guy around anymore as a pole within our political coalition, and then lose all of his diehard supporters, or if they're going to just double down and say, you know, the Q people and the, you know, these anti-statist militia groups and the Proud Boys, they're the new face of the Republican Party. So I think that Trump has really left the Republicans in shambles and with a real, you know, a potential civil war on their hands within the party. And it's certainly incredibly dangerous for our country because of how much they're willing to move towards the latter and embrace the lunatic fringe element. But I am not sorry to see him go. I think that's something probably a lot of your listeners can get on board with, is thank God.
No,
more.
I, except for an occasional troll, I do not believe there's any MAGA lovers that listen to the show. Definitely not on a regular basis. When I was reading your essay, it occurred to me that every now and then a Donald Trump would offer up something, an idea that was vaguely progressive. And I always thought that Donald Trump was sort of, you know, he had spent a lot of time listening to comics. And so he got a lot of his inspiration from sort of the stream of consciousness of comedians. And so he would go on a stream of consciousness thing. And every now and then, like, he would, you know, he might take a swipe at a tax law that he knew from experience would benefit the well-to-do and they didn't need it. I would hear that. I go, is he ready to lead a charge against this tax law? No. Quickly. The most recent case, Miles, was out of nowhere. Donald Trump, who hadn't been paying attention to any of the job aspects of being president, was only paying attention to trying to undo the election that he lost, said that the $600 that Congress had decided people should get in this country as a stimulus in the middle of the pandemic was not enough. It should be 2,000. He put it out in a tweet. He may have said it at a moment, and then he quickly dropped it. He didn't put the pressure on Mitch McConnell and the Republic. It passed in the House. Nancy Pelosi called his bluff and died in the Senate where the Republicans control it. And so it seems like he understood how rigged the system is against people who weren't wealthy like him, but he wasn't going to do a damn thing to change it.
No, I mean, I don't think it was ever a question of even political will. I think there was just a complete lack of interest. I mean, he was just clinging for anything to, rail against the establishment on. And if it was $2,000 checks, so be it, you know, but there was no underlying kind of moral thread connecting any of these. What he talked about a lot more than $2,000 checks was about water pressure and shower heads. I mean, that's been his like latest bet noir that he's going off about. I mean, that's that just goes to show the kind of manic nature of how he's approached, you know, policy questions. And I think it's what has made him so toxic is because there's no, I mean, the constituency for him is his diehard supporters at this point. And the Republican Party is, you know, thrown their lot in with him. So, of course, there's plenty of just lifelong Republicans now that are, you know, Trumpists essentially for the long haul. But he was never a great vehicle for the Republican Party besides doing their two major objectives, which were stacking the judiciary with right-wing nominees, which certainly they succeeded at. I mean, it's that I think will be the longest lasting legacy. Certainly of the Trump era will be the all the right-wing judges we now have on the bench at the federal level. And then also just, you know, helping corporate America. I mean, that's the constant, goal of the Republican Party has been to be the party of corporate power. Now, Democrats have also gotten in on that game as well. But what we've seen in the past week has been this huge shift in which all these corporations have stopped, have turned off the valves. They don't want to be associated with, you know, a seditionist caucus. So they're no longer supporting these Republicans. And if anything, that's the motivating factor for McConnell to try to, stop that slide into just, you know, embracing the storm the Capitol, stop the steal folks, is because that's a path towards, you know, economic destitution for the Republican Party. And that's the only thing that McConnell cares about is power and maintaining his, you know, caucus. And right now that's being threatened precisely because of Donald Trump and his supporters and their actions.
You know, you raise a point that I want to ask you about in terms of what finally was the straw that broke the camel's back for corporate America, which was largely on the sidelines through the 4 or 5 years of Trump and his abominations. They didn't really take a stand once. And I've said this on the show a couple of times. I'll say it to you. I watched that 60 Minutes interview with Raffensperger, the Secretary of State of Georgia, who Trump called up and tried to intimidate into finding the 11,000 votes he needed to reverse Georgia. And they made a point of saying, Miles, that Raffensperger is a lifelong Republican. He supported Trump in 2016. He voted for Trump in 2020. He wanted Trump to win. And this was like a shock. And I think of Raffensperger and I think of corporate America, and I'm like viewing it like, what was the shock about this in particular? How is this different than the way the man ruled for the last 4 or 5 years? What suddenly happened that the light went on? I've been struggling with this, Miles. Corporate America has turned against Donald Trump. It's like that. They were something. What, the insurrection embarrassed them? Is that it? They supported this guy. He was calling for this kind of violence. The carnage speech that you alluded to from 2017 was as nutsy as anything that he delivered at the end. So really was no, Donald Trump was Donald Trump. He was consistent throughout. He supported Nazis in Charlottesburg. Where was corporate America for where was the outrage of Raffensperger and corporate America and I don't know, Nike? I don't know who corporate America is when they say, what changed? Like, what was it, Miles, that suddenly got corporate America to wake up?
Well, I can't speak for them because sadly they have not welcomed me into their ranks. so I don't get invited to the dinners and socials and everything. But what I would, you know, what I would presume is, for one thing, he's out the door already, right? So there's way less legal. There's way less of a, you know, potential downside for them from cutting it off at this point. It's an opportunity, if anything, in order to try to get the more respectable, elite oriented Republican ahead of the pack, essentially, and to, you know, tamp down the Trump ones. But then also, it's a matter of, I mean, the Capitol was stormed. At least five people died. There was certainly members of Congress who felt their lives were under threat. That's a pretty big, you know, motivating factor. I think that you're completely right that the horrors of Charlottesville are, you know, were equally sickening. But I think there is something different when people that are that close to the levers of power feel personally threatened. And they had, you know, they're the people that have the lines of communication to the corporate elite as well. So I think that there was a lot of, you know, signaling that happened there. And they just, a lot of these groups just decided to cut the cord. And hey, this could have like long-term effects. Hallmark, which is one of the biggest employers, they're based in Kansas City, you know, one of the biggest employers in Missouri, they said they're not going to donate to Josh Hawley anymore, who's, you know, their senator. That is a big deal and could have very long lasting effects, because look, in 2 years, I certainly hope not, which is one of the reasons I wrote this article, but in 2 years, Republicans could take the House of Representatives, right? And Kevin McCarthy could be the Speaker of the House. How is he going to deal with the fact that this huge, you know, pipeline of money is suddenly cut off? That I think is a motivating factor for them. And it's all the more reason that Democrats need to keep pushing to excise this, you know, these types of bad actors from the political arena. I think there's no other way to get out of this, because they've shown, you know, a lot of these people have shown themselves. They potentially were giving tours the day before the insurrection to these MAGA people around, you know, showing them how to storm it, essentially. So yeah, you can't be have bipartisanship with a political representative who wants you to be overthrown. I just don't see how that's, you know, that you can make that work.
I'm going to go on a limb here. I just took a note what you were saying about the 20. You're already looking ahead to the next congressional elections, 2022. Traditionally, the party that's out of the White House does well in those midterm elections, as we've been led to believe over the last 30 years or so. And that was definitely the case in 2010, where the Tea Party had their first moment of glory when they ousted the Democrats from charge of the House, defeating Democrats across the board. I'm going to make a prediction, which I'm almost like trying to stop myself from making, because I hate it when I make predictions that are optimistic, generally a pessimistic sort. Years of rooting for Chicago sports teams will do that to you. But I'm hoping at the very least that it's different this time around, in terms of what will occur in the next 2 years, because I believe the Democrats have learned the mistake they made in 2009. And I actually just wrote about this for the Reader. I've been thinking a lot about this. In 2009, there was just such this wave of jubilation at the election of Barack Obama. And there was just outpouring of happiness. Yeah, with that inauguration, I just was rethinking about it and the parties that night. And I do believe the Democratic Party went to sleep. And I don't believe the Democratic Party, they just fell into total love with Barack Obama. It became a cult of Obama. And the Democratic Party did not wake up until 2016 on Election Day, when Donald Trump defeated Hillary Clinton, and Dems everywhere realized how precious and vulnerable this democracy is. And then we saw, of course, the Women's March with the pussy hats in 2017 sort of signaled the fight back, the resistance, if you will, to Donnie Trump. So I am hoping, Miles, and I'd love to get your thoughts on this, that Dems, progressives, liberals, lefties, that whole coalition has learned a lesson from 2009. Definitely Joe Biden is not the charismatic figure that Barack Obama is. So people will not be swooning over him the way they swooned over Barack Obama, and still swoon over the guy. So that's my prediction. What's your reaction?
I agree that that's going to be the test, is whether they can learn that lesson. And I kind of agree with you that I think that the conventional wisdom has switched within Democratic circles. It's moved essentially from that running up deficits and inflation led to Ronald Reagan and led to conservative dominance over our politics. And that was a fear, I think, that motivated Democratic politicians and policymakers for decades, you know, since the Reagan era, essentially. And now we're finally, there is kind of a realignment of thinking of conventional wisdom, which is that Barack Obama and the Democratic Party's hesitancy and inaction and the tepidness of their policies led to Donald Trump, and that's what we have to learn from and act in accordance with, right? In order to not have the same result in another 4 years or even another 2 years, which we saw rightly in the, you know, the Tea Party sweep in 2010, when the Democrats famously got shellacked, as Barack Obama said. you've got to do something different. You can't just, you know, try the same reach across the aisle bipartisanship and pass a stimulus, but don't take credit for anything. And, you know, there was so many missteps, I think, that the Democratic Party made. And you just look at it. I mean, look at from this is a political question as much as it is a policy question. I mean, of course, I want to see people's lives get better because I have, you know, political convictions and everything myself. But I also, the way to do that is to have the Democrats not get decimated in future elections. And under Barack Obama, the Democratic Party lost over 1,000 seats across the country, you know, state houses across the board. You can't have that and also enact anything close to a Biden agenda, right? So the only way to have any political success is to take the lesson that you just said and apply it to your politics. And the way to do that, I mean, I lay out some of this in the article, but is to embrace the things that have worked for the Democrats, right? John Ossoff ran for Senate a few years back and he lost.
Congress.
Yeah, for Congress as for in a special election, and he lost. And he ran on what the Democrats had traditionally been running on under Trump, is just a pretty mealy-mouthed kind of centrist agenda. This time, it was very different. He ran saying, we are going to pass $2,000 checks. We're going to do big, bold policies. These GOP senators are hypocrites that are gaming the system and, you know, they're rich and we're going to look out for the poor and working class. And guess what? He won. So did Warnock. I think that's the lesson. And that's in Georgia, right? So as much as people want to say, oh, only AOC can win in, you know, New York, whatever, it's a message. You don't have to necessarily have all the signals to progressive, you know, so democratic socialist aligned policies. We could still run on an agenda that's about helping working people and make that very clear in your messaging. And I think that both of the Georgia Senate candidates did that. And that's one of the things I hope Democrats learn from going forward.
All right. So what do you want to hear from Joe Biden? I mean, that's the second part of your article. The first part, of course, is the monster that is Donald Trump. And by the way, before we get to that, though, I have to, you mentioned Mitch McConnell, and right before you came on, there was a headline flashed across my phone trying to keep up with the breaking news on this show. It's really hard to do. So much news is breaking. That Mitch McConnell is signaling that he's actually going to, he may vote for impeachment. The headline passed really quickly. But clearly, there's this, like you put it, metaphorical civil war within the Republican Party, where Trump, the Trump lovers are the base. They're the voters. But the elected officials recognize they live in a real world where if you go too far, if you go where the Trump voters are, you're not going to win any statewide elections. You're not going to, you're really going to be handicapped. You can't get corporate money, as you said, et cetera, and so forth. So where do you think the Republicans will go with this? Will they vote for impeachment, in your opinion, when it comes to the Senate?
I don't know. I can't. It's hard for me to imagine. They need, what, like 16 or 17 senators?
17.
And that's hard. I mean, there's a few, obviously, I think like Murkowski and Romney and Susan Collins, maybe, and a few other folks, Ben Sasse and some of these other people will vote for conviction. But getting to 17, I mean, McConnell will definitely have to support it for that to happen. It's just a question of whether they want to rip off this Band-Aid now and say Trump can't run for office, federal office again, and we don't have this hanging over our heads as a party for the next 4 years, let alone, you know, into the future. Or if we're going to continue to abide it as a party and just try to keep this coalition somehow together. I don't know. I mean, I don't think that it would be wise for them to let Trump off the hook on this, of course, because I think it's a huge threat to our democracy, let alone to, you know, their own self-interest as a political party. But I also am not as, I think that the Republican, Mitch McConnell will, you know, has already plotting out a plan, I'm sure, of how he's going to obstruct Joe Biden at every step. And there's nothing that brings unity together in a political party like a common enemy. And I guarantee that day one, you're going to stop stop hearing all this stuff about the Civil War and the Republican Party. It'll still be happening, but they're going to project a unified opposition to Joe Biden and the Democrats. And I think that will do a lot of the work of kind of cohesing the party. But it's still hard for me to imagine them getting 17 Republican senators to vote against Trump when they've all gone along with his crazy stuff and most insane, dangerous claims he's made for all these years to now suddenly show a backbone would be a shock to me. But I mean, I think they should do it. And I think it would be in their own best interest to do it. But we'll see very soon.
A headline is McConnell weighing impeachment says Capitol mob was provoked by Trump and the mob was fed by lies. So, yeah, I think that McConnell up to something. It would be a pretty slick move on his part, Miles, if he followed your advice. You know, Mitch McConnell's big listener of the show, especially when you come on.
Real quick, because you mentioned breaking news, I thought maybe the breaking news you were going to mention was that apparently on Donald Trump's long list of pardons, it includes the Tiger King himself. And the Tiger King now has a limo waiting for him to take him from jail. This is real.
You made that up.
It is true. I mean, I don't know if he's going to actually be pardoned, but he expects to be, and he has a limo waiting outside of the jail to take him to some press conference or something. So the Tiger King might be back.
And wow. I mean, I that was the other thing. I mean, that's a tangent within a tangent. But all the, don't let me forget the advice you're giving to Mitch McConnell, but all the pardons, I mean, I don't know when technically Donald Trump is no longer president. I don't know, like, does it happen the moment that Joe Biden is sworn in? I guess that's when it happens. So he could issue a pardon from Mar-a-Lago tomorrow at 4 a.m. or something. I don't know the legalities of it. I keep thinking of like different people. I keep thinking that he's going to pardon Blago. You know, like he commuted the sentence, so Blago was let free. Okay, so now he's I saw Blago issued a statement yesterday praising Donald Trump effusively and saying that I can't even get the words out because it's so bizarre. Like Joe Biden should give Donald Trump a medal for representing the voice of the voiceless. These lunatics in MAGA are voiceless. Anyway, when I saw that, I go, oh. I'm trying to put myself in the mind of Blago. He's trying to get something. He probably wants a pardon. You know what I mean? So he can really go on with his life, maybe run for office again, be a lawyer. I don't know. So I wouldn't be surprised if the Tiger King and Blago got pardoned in the next 24 hours.
Really is Motley Crue of the Trump supporters out there. You got wide range from Tiger King to Blago. He hosted an event before the election here that was called Blacks for Trump, which is a very troubling, problematic name for an event for the first place that could then be hosted by Blago. But it goes to show how absurd the whole situation is.
No, but yeah, it is absurd. And then there'll be some really rich people who get pardoned. I mean, who are probably paying Trump.
Exactly. We're not going to know the names of the vast majority of the people that will get pardoned. It will all be kind of political and economic favors.
All right. So going back to McConnell's maneuver, and I could see it. One, pull a bandage off the wound with an impeachment vote that prevents Donald Trump from ever running again. So he's off of Twitter. He can't run again. The Republican Party can slowly begin the process taking back the party from Donald Trump. And then you're absolutely correct. Just pivot and suddenly become deficit hawks and oppose absolutely everything Joe Biden does. And then so you become the party of opposition. And that, I think, is probably what they figure is the best way out of it. Cut the tie with Trump and just start opposing everything that Biden does. Is that a sense of it?
Well, the problem that they have is that if they've done these polls of Trump voters, of voters who just voted for Donald Trump, like, you know, a few weeks ago, and they asked them who are they, you know, hold allegiance to, the Republican Party or Donald Trump, and the vast, vast majority say Donald Trump over the Republican Party. So how are you going to manage that? You know, that's the question, I think, is whether this kind of the whatever 30% of the country or so that's just diehard Trump supporters if they're going to be willing to get back into the GOP bandwagon. Because look, this was a record-breaking election in terms of turnout. Donald Trump, like, activated and mobilized a lot of supporters that I don't think are necessarily would even come out for just a generic GOP candidate. I'm sure he turned off plenty of people too that ended up voting Democratic, but that's the question. It's like, they're going to be in a poor situation, at least in comparison to the Democratic Party, either way, regardless of what they do. But I think that if they have any hope of kind of turning the page on this chapter, because look, Donald Trump, it was terrible. Like, we all know this was a really bad, they don't even want to be seen with him tomorrow. He's doing this big send off thing. And, you know, Scaramucci said he can't make it. Pence can't make it. They were all invited. Kevin McCarthy's not going. So nobody wants to be associated with this guy at all. He's at the worst, you know, level of popularity of his entire presidency. He's toxic. So, that said, 74 million people voted for him. So then how do you, you know, kind of manage that if you're, you know, a power player in Republican politics? I don't know. Thankfully, nobody's asking my opinion.
Well, I think the way to go for them will be the way that you said it. They're going to immediately turn against everything Joe Biden proposes. So, all right, that gets to the second part of the equation. What should Joe Biden do? It's 50-50. He cannot afford to lose one vote in the Senate to pass initiatives. I'm not talking about executive orders. And it's also very close in the House. I can't remember the exact breakdown. So what do you think Joe Biden should do?
Well, I mean, I know not everyone agrees with this, and there will certainly be some pushback. I think it would be a lot of arm pulling on to Joe Manchin specifically, and even Kristen Sinema. These are kind of the two most conservative Democrats in the Senate. But you only need 51 votes to change the rules of the Senate. And so you can immediately get rid of the legislative filibuster. If you keep your caucus together, they, you know, did this before for judicial nominees, then McConnell did it for Supreme Court justices, so he could get, you know, Kavanaugh and Amy Coney Barrett through. So you can just ask with a majority vote policies that you want to enact. Right now, under Senate rules, any senator can object, and then you have a filibuster and you got to get 60 votes. They could immediately overturn that, and they've got some time now, you know, before any other elections are held, that if they can just pass a really comprehensive, bold agenda that's going to help working people, it's going to fulfill their campaign promises, it's going to build goodwill, and that will show what a page has been turned since the Trump years. You know, if they do things like a $15 minimum wage, which, I mean, get to his credit, Joe Biden made a forceful case for that and including it in the most immediate relief bill. I think that would be, it's an insanely popular policy. It passed in Florida, not exactly, you know, the bluest of places. So you do that kind of stuff, you start to win some credit. I think you've got, people don't trust government, and that for good reason, I think, and that's been ingrained for a long time. They don't see government as a vehicle for bettering their lives. They see it as an impediment. And partially that's because of ideology and messaging that has been pushed by, again, bad actors for a long time. But it's also because government has done a shit poor job of, you know, actually doing their job to, you know, be serving the people. And so the best way to kind of overturn that frame of thinking is to do your job and, you know, do the things that the people want you to do. And so infrastructure, I think, will be huge. And that's one area that I think Joe Manchin can really be won over on. Look, there was a big thing under Obama that was Democrats said, we're not going to do any pork. We're going to cut all the pork out of the bills, right? And these are kind of just little handouts to representatives to make them, you know, help their constituents so that they can feel they won something out of the bill. Under Obama, Democrats said, we don't want to do that anymore. We want, you know, good government and all this stuff. Well, but then by doing that, then, you know, it's almost like aldermanic privilege or prerogative or something. You know, it's like if you take away the ability for representatives to help their constituents or at least feel like they get a win out of something, they're going to be way less likely to get behind your program. So I think Democrats should be willing to give Manchin all kinds of stuff to, you know, name stuff after him, build bridges in West Virginia, whatever you got to do to win over the support to get some bigger goals done. And that means, you know, tackling the climate crisis, and of course means figuring out this vaccine rollout, because it's a complete mess right now and a disaster. So doing that, and then, you know, sending more money. Look, if there's a reason $2,000 checks are so popular, because people are broke and they want money. And even if they're not totally broke, they could use some more money. So, and we've broken the seal. We've shown that government can do that, right? People already have their bank accounts set up so that they can get direct deposits. Just start doing that stuff. And I think that that's the way that the Democrats are going to win some support. I think it was stupid. I don't think it was, you know, super politically advantageous for Donald Trump to put his name on the checks. Like, that was his big thing, whether you got to get my name on the checks, and you know, delayed the rollout. But I think it was smart for him to claim credit for that. And I think that probably had something to do with all the support that he got in the election, is because people associated him with getting money. And, you know, he got more working class support in 2020. So I think Democrats should take that lesson. And, you know, Obama, under Obama and the stimulus, then they tried to kind of secretly do all these tax relief plans that people didn't even know that they were getting. Democrats should claim that at every step and say, look, we're doing this in order to make your life better. So, I mean, there's a whole, I could go on and on and on, but I think that, you know, just be bold, right? And don't try to get, you know, sunk into the snake charming of supposed bipartisanship, because I really don't think there's much of a chance for that. I know that McConnell and Biden are like going to church together tomorrow or something, and they're trying to, like, you know, be buddy buddy, but I don't see the strategy of the GOP changing one stitch from when Obama was president.
I missed that. I actually did miss that, the going to church part. I did. So that's like they're substituting McConnell for Trump, because the thing is, when you usually have the transition, well, they don't go to church together, but, you know, the incoming president would meet, go to the White House and meet the outgoing president, and their spouses would be there, and they would ride together to the inauguration. I remember Obama doing that with Trump, and Obama doing that with W doing that with Clinton, et cetera, and so forth. So now, I guess, as a substitute for Trump, he's going to meet with McConnell. Wow, what a weird stuff. All right, we'll close with this question. Bernie's role in all this. Miles Kampflesson, as everybody knows who listens to him on this show, big Bernie supporter, as was I. I'm not dumping on Bernie just because he lost. So what do you think Bernie's role is going to be in the coming months?
Well, he's got a very influential role, in fact, because he's now, because the Democrats won those races in Georgia, there's a whole, I mean, the landscape is very different than it was in 2009. In 2009, Financial Services Committee, I think it was Chris Dodd, right? Which is why it was the Dodd-Frank Act. And he is big, you know, credit card guy, centrist Dem. Now it's Sherrod Brown. The banking committee, I forget who it was before, but it was another kind of centrist, a debt hawk, actually, was the head of the budget committee when Obama came in. Now the head of the budget committee is going to be Bernie Sanders. And so from that role, he oversees the one area in American politics, or at least in congressional legislating, where you can use a 51 vote majority to pass big stuff. And that's budget reconciliation. It's a, you know, whatever, it's a kind of, you know, it's got, it basically is a rule in which you can get things passed that you are reconciling the budget. And so you can do things that relate to budgetary measures. And that includes things like passing a $15 minimum wage. It includes things like sending out survival checks. It includes all kinds of parts of the Biden economic program. So Bernie's going to be overseeing that. And my prediction is, we'll see what happens, but my prediction is they'll do some play at trying to get 9 Republicans to support this initial plan that Biden laid out last week, this $1.9 trillion immediate relief package. They said they're going to try to get it bipartisan. Not going to happen. No chance. They might get like 1 or 2, maybe, but I doubt that. I think McConnell's going to be good at holding his caucus together. And then, you know, and then it's going to be up to Bernie to figure out how to get that through budget reconciliation. And I think that's immediately where they should pivot as soon as it's clear, like day one, would be like, forget all that. How much can we do through this, this process? So I think that's a great role for Bernie because, I mean, he made a play for labor secretary that didn't work out, understandably. I mean, they need to keep their majority in the Senate for right now. But as head of the budget committee, he can do a lot to improve working people's lives, much as he would have in the labor department. And I think we should ready ourselves for a very different, we should have different expectations of what government is going to do versus, look, we were all worried for 4 years there's going to be another like Muslim ban coming up or something. That's, we're going to be operating in a different, you know, state of affairs now where it's going to be more on offense rather than worrying about horrible things that government can do. How do you push government to do the most they possibly can to fulfill the goals of the stuff even that Bernie ran on? I mean, Biden says he wants to be the most progressive president since Franklin Delano Roosevelt. This is a prime time to show that commitment. And so I think Bernie's going to try to hold him to that. I think Bernie's supporters will have that expectation. And so, you know, it's up to Joey B to come through.
By the way, I'm so happy that Bernie didn't get labor. I can't tell you. I was like, no, come on. Being a part of the Biden team for Bernie Sanders was not a good fit. I love that he's to chair a budget. Much more, in my opinion, power than being labor secretary. Marty Walsh, I'm sure, will be a fine labor secretary. I'm hoping he'll be a fine labor secretary. So, yes, Bernie. I'm so happy. I know you wanted it, apparently, but I'm glad you didn't get it. All right, Miles, thank you very much.
Miles, actually, we did, and actually, I'm sorry to interrupt. I was going to ask a favor from you, Miles, if you didn't mind.
Lay it on me.
All right, cool. February 27th will be our 2-year anniversary as a podcast. And what I'm having our guests do is I'm having them, you know, like on the radio, hi, you know, my name is Miles Camp. I'd ask you to do this. My name is Miles Camp Lassen, and I want to wish the Benjirovsky Show a happy 2-year anniversary. Would you be cool doing something like that?
Yeah.
All right. Sure. Cool. Right now? Yeah, we'll do it right now. I'll give you a countdown, and then you just say, hey, you know, it's Miles Camp Lassen. Say whatever you want, okay?
Okay. Lay on.
All right, cool. Here we go. 3, 2, 1, go for it.
Hey, everybody. This is Miles Camp Lassen, a writer and editor at In These Times magazine and a frequent guest of the Ben Jirovsky Show. Just want to wish both Ben and Dr. D a very happy 2 years, a very vital source of information in this, you know, troubled time. And, you know, there's very few media sources you can rely on for quality content the way you can from the Ben Jirovsky Show. So happy birthday.
Oh, wow.
Oh, man, that was really good. The guy, I saw him do it. He just whipped it. He didn't have it written or anything.
That was really sweet.
That was really good.
Oh, and hey, go Dolphins.
Hey, I appreciate that. And I got to give a shout out because I told Ben this earlier. I finally watched the great series City So Real and was very happy to not only see Ben Jirovsky on the screen, but also heard Dr.
Yeah,
D.
Yeah. I watched that the other day too, and I'm like, oh wow, that's okay, cool. That's exactly how I'd want to be in a movie. You can just hear me. Perfect.
Yeah. That was from the shoot that was in the studio with Ricky Hendon, dear friend of this show, a former state senator, Ricky Hendon. And that was back in the old days before I got fired at the radio station. So yeah, Steve James, we did a whole series on City So Real, Miles. We did, was it 4 or 5 parts? Brought in different people who were from the show. I had Steve James on, Ricky Hendon was on, Mace Jackson was on, the Tuttons from The Hideout were on, and Neil Salas Griffin was on. So I was really moved by that TV show. I thought it was a great show. And I'm now urging everybody to watch One Night in Miami. We're going to do a whole series on that one as well. I've already started reaching out to guests. Really powerful show about black men, basically. Sam Cooke. I mean, these are legends, icons. Jim Brown, Sam Cooke, Malcolm X, and Muhammad Ali. How can I forget the great Muhammad Ali, my hero when I was a kid? So great. Regina King, man, what a great director, great movie. So we're probably going to do a whole special on that. Unfortunately, I'm not in that movie. It's So Real. So anyway, Miles, stay safe, stay sound. We'll talk to you real soon, all right?
Thanks. Have a good one.
All right, that's a great Miles Kampf lesson. Do you any updates before we head out that door?
Absolutely, I do. Once again, yes, our anniversary, 2-year anniversary. Ben, happy anniversary.
Thank you. The flowers are in the mail.
Oh,
wait, time out. We still have a month, right?
Yeah, but hey, come on. We're selling it here, pal. Come on. It's coming up.
Bring those flowers back. Not for another month, okay?
February 27th. put it in the freezer like that cake from...
Oh, my God, the cake. Get that...
It's going to be on February 27th. That's on a Saturday. We're going to drop a special 2-year anniversary show. I got some stuff in mind, so be on the lookout for that. All right, you were just talking about City So Real. Let's go to City So Weird. I'm talking about the weirdness in Winnetka.
Oh, yes, thank you. Oh, my God, I forgot. I said don't... I forgot it. Yes.
The following comes from the Chicago Sun-Times.
Oh, God.
Matthew Hendrickson and apparently a bunch of others. A North Suburban clothing shop that installed a QAnon-themed window display last spring is owned by the wife of the CEO of At Properties, the real estate firm that fired an agent who attended the March to Save America that devolved into a riot in the nation's capital. The company announced it was immediately terminating the agent, Libby McCarthan Andrews, over social media posts she made about, quote, storming the Capitol for President Donald Trump on January 6th in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, so much to discuss here. I want to give a shout out to Matthew Hendrickson. Great job. I used to do stories like this all the time, D. These bizarre, we call them neighborhood news. Every now and then I would venture out of the city, but mostly it was in Chicago. Just strange stories about Chicago. Well, they weren't always strange, but stories that kind of reveal the side of Chicago or the neighborhood or the personalities, the quirky people that live in Chicago. This is a classic story of what? Do as I say, not as I do. It's why, you know, when I try to think about a logic that would govern somebody to join the Trump cult, it would be how unfair and inconsistent the world is. And this story just sums it all up. As we all know, QAnon is the whacked out weirdo political movement of sorts that, what is it? How do I say it? They believe that there's a secret satanic cult of pedophiles who are controlling government and that Donald Trump is the chief of resistance. Just want to point out that Donald Trump was good friends with Jeffrey Epstein. Okay, so it's whacked out on that front right there. I mean, it's so bizarre to think that a significant number of Americans have signed on to that. At the same time, I've been living a long time. I've seen all kinds of cults come and go. I've seen all kinds of weirdo movements come and go. So I shouldn't be surprised by anything. But this is a real political force. Some of the people who stormed the Capitol last week were QAnon supporters. I think there's at least one congressperson that got elected. Marjorie Taylor Greene from Georgia. Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene is an advocate of QAnon. So it's out there. It's potent. It's real. And apparently the woman who's married to the head of At Properties is a believer in it. I say apparently because it's one of these things, D. One of these, like, if you're rich, you get a spokesperson to cover it all up for you. So the head of At Properties is everybody. I don't know if you know this, but they're like the biggest real estate company or one of the big real estate companies in the Chicagoland area. You know, little At thing, properties, little At thing. Hence, anyway, they're everywhere. They're powerful. So the wife of the owner runs a boutique in Winnetka, fashion store. Now, Winnetka, I got to help you out here. For our geographically challenged listeners, is a suburb, a really rich suburb north of Chicago. So I will now do it. It's Evanston. Wilmette,
nice.
I believe Kenilworth, and then Winnetka. Ooh. I believe that's the lineup.
Yeah,
I think it is. The thing is like it's kind of a weird thing. I'm North Shore. I moved to Evanston when I was in sixth grade, and I lived in Evanston throughout high school. So I know the North Shore. but I always get mixed up. Winnetka and Kenilworth. Like, which one is next? You know what I'm saying? They got some issues with that. I got to really work that out.
I think it goes Winnetka, then Kenilworth.
I think
Wilmette, Winnetka, Kenilworth. I could be wrong.
Definitely you're not North Shore. You're from Alton.
I ride my bike around there all the time.
North Shore guy. Dennis, I went to Evanston High School, okay? Very proud of that fact. And I passed freshman algebra. A stunning moment in my academic career. Anyway, so, you know, it's like Gentile, Winnetka. You get this notion that people in Winnetka would not like Donald Trump. No, this lady's got this boutique. She's a themed, a QAnon themed display with a mannequin with a QAnon hat. Like, why did she think that was appropriate? So anyway, they get caught. Now, as Dennis pointed out, the inconsistencies of the world. Some real estate agent who was at the insurrection got fired, right? Isn't that what you said, D? So they fired the real estate agent. Meanwhile, the boss's wife with the QAnon thing, hello? Little inconsistent there. Here's the official statement from the media representative. They have a spokesperson, okay, D? I'm going to get a spokesperson whenever the media calls me. You're going to be my spokesperson, all right? All questions will go through Dr. D. I think you could do a better job than the spokesperson. The spokesperson pointed to posts that Kelly Golden, that's the CEO's wife, made on social media, in which she said a friend of a friend asked her to display the information and gave her the QAnon braces. She said she did not know the theory's origins, but displayed the information anyway. An acquaintance introduced me to someone, and they asked if I would put this sign in one of my windows. The day we had to close our shop, I trusted the simplicity of the statement, remain calm, which is a QAnon statement, during the unprecedented time. I don't know, D, what do you think? Do you buy that? Do you think that she really didn't know that she was putting up some QAnon stuff? It's kind of throwing that friend under the bus. Isn't that the thing? The unnamed friend. I don't, you know, D, it's like one of those things. Did Lori Lightfoot not really know about Anjanette Young? Like she said she did in her press statement. You know, did Johnny Canizera, the Fraternal Order of Police, not really know the full extent of what was going down at the Capitol when he told the reporter from BEZ, oh, come on, it's just a bunch of guys having fun. You know, did Bruce Rauner really cry when the verdict came in on Laquan McDonald? Okay, these are just some of the things. They say stuff and you got to wonder, is it true? You know, did Rahm Emanuel never see the Laquan McDonald video? First time I ever heard of it. I don't know. We live in a time where truth, it's hard to, it's like a huge chunk of the Republican Party believes that Donald Trump actually won the election that he obviously lost. So it's really hard to know what's true when everybody's lying all the time or believing lies. I don't know. I saw this story and I just thought so many things. Number one, like, wealth can buy you a lot. And so it can buy you respectability. So all these people out of Winnetka, I wonder how many QAnon supporters are out in Winnetka. You know, they don't make fun of people from Winnetka like they make fun of Trump voters from downstate. But apparently, they think it's really cool, the QAnon hat. You know, wow, it's really hip style. And man, the mannequin is so skinny. Do you see the picture? Like, I admit, I'm not really into fashion.
Yeah.
But just like, they're really sort of, this notion, it's like she's bulimic or something. Wow, there's some kind of weird thing going on in Winnetka clothing shops.
I don't know if I've ever seen a fat mannequin.
I like how Mannequin Little, you know, at least suggests that there's a little chunkiness there, okay? That's how most people are.
No, not even that kid. We're all skinny. We're all super thin and in great shape because we do yoga every minute of the day and then starve ourselves. We live in Winnetka, which is the suburb just north of Wilmette. We're even richer than the people in Wilmette. Uh-oh, people are going to know, wait a minute, is Wilmette, is Winnetka where Rahm Emanuel came from? Good question, listeners. The answer is no. Former mayor of the city of Chicago is from Wilmette, not Winnetka. Thank you for asking.
See how he does that, guys, where he's like talking to himself, but like talking to you too. It's pretty cool, right?
I'm as nutty as those QAnon supporters. I talk to myself. Hi, Ben. How are you doing today? I'm doing really well. How are you doing? Really good. I'm going to sing a song to myself. Okay.
Ladies,
I'm not going to have an imaginary phone conversation with Phyllis. Hi, Phyllis.
Hi, Ben.
No, I'm just saying, Winnetka, bunch of hypocrites.
They promise they won't tax retirement income if their constitutional amendment passes.
It's like four Phyllises today.
Phyllis, heck of a job, Phyllis, of course. Retiree from, I don't know, Park Ridge. Helped defeat the fair tax. Heck of a job, Phyllis. Good job.
Yeah, so
and good job, all you voters on the Northwest side, for voting against it, because you heard a Phyllis commercial.
Yeah, so, ladies and gentlemen, someone in Winnetka has those documents. That is the latest. In the weirdness in Winnetka.
Yeah.
And no live stream chat listener Doogie. I didn't ride my bike around Lake Michigan. That was Mayor Rahm.
I just biked around Lake Michigan, nearly 1,000 miles.
Okay.
That's today's show. That's today's show, guys. Make sure to follow us online at Benny J Show, BENNY, the letter J Show, on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can always send us an email, BennyJShow@gmail.com. And yes, we have a phone number, 708-658-4788. That number again is 708-658-4788. You can download previous Ben Jarofsky shows, Benny J bonus interviews, and so much more at ChicagoReader.com and wherever else you download podcasts. And hey, if you download, check us out on the live stream chat sometimes, Tuesdays through Fridays, 1 until 3 p.m. Central Time, Chicago Reader YouTube channel.
I want to thank Miles Konflessen, the pride and joy of Whitney Young, In These Times, ace editor, reporter, great job as he always does, and of course, the man, the myth, the legend, the pride and joy of Illinois, without whom the show would be possible. And it's Miles Konflessen, Phyllis, and all the QAnon supporters of Winnetka will tell you, back home in Alton, they call him White Lightning. Give yourself a raise, take it out of petty cash. See you tomorrow, everybody.
Just biked around Lake Michigan, nearly 1,000 miles. Nearly 1,000 miles. Nearly 1,000 miles. I just biked around Lake Michigan. Nearly 1,000 miles.